Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the March 2019 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Adrian Banning, faculty member, research coordinator, and EBM course director at the Drexel Physician Assistant Program in Philadelphia. That's in Pennsylvania.
And I'm your other co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA Program in Memphis, Tennessee. So this month, we feature CME articles on opiate use in pregnancy, acute monoarthropathy, special article on PA specialization, and cannabinoid for refractory seizures.
Mm-hmm. Cannabinoid, we're going to interchange it. I don't know. There's probably a right way, but I think there's no wrong way to say a proper noun.
I would agree with that.
Okay. Before we get into any of that, we have our question from the editor. Harrison asks us this month, Adrian and Chris, congratulations. Oh, I forgot this was about us. Adrian and Chris, congratulations on your newest podcasting project, Airways and Educators, a great resource for PA educators. Both of you are leaders in the world of PA education and have a wealth of knowledge and experience that we only begin to tap into on the JAPA podcast. When it comes to medical education or education in general, what do you think is the most difficult thing to teach someone and why?
So for me, it is teaching someone how to learn. Not necessarily telling them how to learn, because I think that in education in general, we get caught up with the sage on the stage, you need to learn this, and this is what will be on the test. Mm-hmm. And as we all know from being practicing PAs, we have to get continuing medical education credits, and we have to constantly look up things that we don't know about. And that is a skill that you sort of learn with experience, but one of the things that I try to do as an educator is, instead of being the sage on the stage, be the guide on the side and show them, hey, this is where you can look to find some of this stuff. Here's a resource that you can use. If you're not sure about this, look this up. Let's talk about it. Let's develop a differential and really get to teaching them how to learn as opposed to telling them how to learn.
I agree with you that that is our most important task. You didn't actually say that, but I think that I'm going to summarize and say that teaching someone how to learn and be a lifelong learner is really what we do here. We share a lot of facts. That is really hard. The hardest thing for me is that teaching someone to trust themselves, please stop changing your exam answers. Trust yourself, but then also not too much. Like, do more, do less. Trust your intuition. It's the group of all your experiences. It's not this magic thing coming to you, but also always continue to question yourself. And that fine line between, am I doing a good job or do I just think I'm doing a good job? I think I struggle with that. I hope I always struggle with that. I think it's really hard to explain to someone where the sweet spot is because that might not be theirs. So trying to teach someone, especially a newer learner, this feels really weird. It is a difficult process to go through PA school, but you got to trust yourself at some point. And then when it starts to feel really good and easy, then ask yourself, why? Why does it feel so good? Am I trusting myself too much? That's the hardest thing for me.
I mean, there's a lot of those skills in education that are tough to teach, are difficult to learn, but it's part of the process of learning in medicine. I would argue that we're in a profession where you can never know everything there is to know because the body of evidence is constantly changing. And I know that there's other professions out there that could say the exact same thing, but I kind of, right. You know, math's kind of math, you know? Like, again, I'm not downplaying our mathematician friends, but there you know those core processes, whereas what we knew about peptic ulcer disease 20 years ago has dramatically changed to what we're doing right now. And so you just have to be okay with not knowing sometimes and figure out how do you need to get that information to best take care of your patients.
Yeah, it's this funny balance because you need a certain amount of ego to be kind of the leader of someone's health decision sometimes. It should be shared decision-making, but then also set that ego aside and say, yesterday what you thought was correct isn't anymore, and just let it go.
Yep, 100%, 100%. So,
Harrison, you make us think, and this month you made us blush a little bit too. Thanks for your kind words.
Yes, thank you, Harrison. So as a disclaimer, this podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition, and we share our take and opinions, but they don't represent JAPA, the authors, the editors, or the publisher's opinions. And this is not intended as medical advice.
Right. This is not medical advice. But it is CME. Onto the CME. And a reminder that when you read both CME articles, and we're going to cover them both, and you do the review post-test, take the online test. If you get at least 70% on both of them, you get one Category 1 CME. So don't forget, go get your CME.
So onward to the CME articles. Our first article up is opioid use in pregnancy. And this was written at the time. Students Lillian C. Carter and Molly Reed, who were PA students at the University of Lynchburg in Lynchburg, Virginia, with Laura Reed, PAC, who is Director of Didactic Education at Lynchburg, Joyce Nichols, who is the Director of Evaluation and Assessment and Compliance in the PA program at Lynchburg, and Eric Schmidt, who is an Assistant Professor at the University of Lynchburg. So the numbers that we want to dive into with this is opioid-involved deaths are 5 times higher than they were in 1999. In 2010, heroin deaths increased dramatically. In 2013, synthetic opioid overdoses increased dramatically. And in 2015, the CDC stated that heroin use doubled in 18 to 25-year-olds over the last 10 years. So this is a significant epidemic that I'm sure you all heard about in some form or fashion over the last several years. So what are the pregnancy concerns with women that use opioids during pregnancy? There is an increased risk of congenital anomalies that can occur, and neonatal abstinence syndrome can occur in women who use opioids during the antepartum period, which can substantially increase the hospitalization of the newborns after delivery, as well as the hospital costs that go with that. So in 2017, ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, gave some recommendations of how best to treat pregnant women who have been identified as having opioid use disorder. And they recommend the SBIRT strategy, S-B-I-R-T. And what that stands for is screening, brief intervention, and refer for treatment. Screening, they recommend using any of the validated opioid screening tools. And the article highlights a few of these in Table 1, which is the National Institute on Drug Abuse Quick Screen, the CRAFT, C-A-R-C-R-A-F-F-T, or the 4Ps Plus. All of these are available to be able to use that can be helpful in screening pregnant women for opioid use disorder. The next section is the brief intervention, and they recommend just engaging in a brief, non-judgmental conversation because, again, you're going to be their primary care provider for the entirety of their pregnancy. So starting that conversation off in a non-judgmental way is going to be able to help best take care of mom as well as baby. You want to provide feedback and advice about strategies that you could help with in terms of the use or the strategies to help treat opioid use, as well as discuss there are some states that have mandatory reporting for pregnant women who report opioid use as well. So you need to know up front what your state laws are and whether or not you're a mandatory reporter and be able to have those conversations with your patients as well. And then the last section is to refer for treatment. And there's two options that they highlight in this article. There is the opioid detoxification, which they don't necessarily recommend because there is some potentially increased fetal risk due to relapse in the mother who then the baby is taking opioids and then not and withdrawing and lapsing and back and forth. It can be done, but it's very, very structured and can be particularly rough on mom and baby. But they really highlight the medication-assisted treatment or the MAT using either methadone or buprenorphine. So methadone is the gold standard for pregnancy. There's a lot of data behind it. There are strategies in place and protocols in place for this. The issue, one of the issues with it is it has to be started inpatient, so they have to have a hospital stay as you start the methadone. But there is more structured support and supervision as a result of the data that has been collected on how best to do this for mom so that it's the safest for both mom and the infant. And then what's sort of newer coming out is the buprenorphine, who you can use and you can start outpatient, which is great. So you don't have to admit them to the hospital. You don't need to have an overnight stay or anything else. This can be started outpatient. But the problem is there's not a lot of good structured data to suggest what's the best way to be able to go through with this. So you're going to have to just look at some of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology's recommendations on how best to use this medication. Other considerations in women who are pregnant with opioid use is breastfeeding. Contrary to maybe what you thought or a popular belief, you can actually breastfeed while undergoing treatment. These medicines do not secrete into the breast milk in any significant concentrations to cause harm to the infant, so it's actually recommended for women to continue breastfeeding. And then also for analgesia during delivery in the postpartum period. Obviously, these women are going to need higher doses of medications for pain control, so you can't use this like a cookie-cutter approach about what's your standard dosing regimen for certain systemic analgesics, because these women who are undergoing treatment may need higher doses in order to control their pain during this period. So again, a good article wrapping around a different patient population than we're used to talking about with opioid use, but some really good information to help that particular patient population.
I really appreciate this article and just how it addresses this crisis, this epidemic that we're going through. And of course, it's going to affect pregnant women and their infants. So I think this is helpful no matter what realm of medicine you're working in. It's touching everyone's lives.
Yep.
Our next CME article is Acute Monoarthritis by Jill M. Ellis, DHSC, MPAS, PAC. She's an associate professor in the PA program at Grand Valley State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. She has no conflicts of interest, and she's going to tell us all about monoarthritis in one article. Great article. Highly recommend it. What is monoarthritis? Just like it sounds, pain associated with physical signs of joint inflammation or degenerative changes in one joint for less than 2 to 4 weeks, because we're talking acute here. It's common, wide variety of severity of differentials. It could be nothing. It could be lethal. You definitely need to know the zebras from the horses here and when you got to take it up a notch. The things you cannot miss are septic arthritis. That's an emergent concern. You cannot miss a fracture. You cannot miss osteomyelitis, compartment syndrome, tumors, necrotizing fasciitis, or systemic vasculitides. The most common cause of acute monoarthritis, though, is not one of those emergent concerns. It's really crystal deposition diseases, so gout, pseudogout. Just an aside, I remember that pseudogout is the positively birefringent crystals because they both start with P. So if that helps you at all. Another common cause is, back into the article, septic arthritis, trauma, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, undifferentiated arthritis, other primary inflammatory arthritides, which is a fun word to say, such as the seronegative spondyloarthropathies. It's often broken down, monoarthritis that is often broken down by acuity, inflammation, location, and number of joints affected. So those kind of four categories can help you think about it a little bit more. Table one in this article is beautiful, breaks it down to inflammatory and non. What's the onset? What's the location of symptoms? So it goes through gout, pseudogout, septic arthritis, trauma, osteo, rheumatoid, and those seronegative spondyloarthropathies for you. Highly recommend you go to that table. It really just helps remind you of which one's inflammatory, which one isn't. Is it intra-articular? Is it articular? So to give you a little bit more background, we're going to talk about synovitis a lot, and if there is synovitis, that's inflammation of the joint membrane in those synovial joints. It's characteristic of inflammatory arthritis, and it presents with pain with movement, joint diffusion, and warmth over the joint. If it's an inflammatory condition, they have pain with inactivity and morning stiffness that normally goes away in like half an hour, 30 minutes of use. Non-inflammatory processes don't have that. They have pain that gets worse with prolonged use. If you have pain that originates from intra-articular structures, that pain is typically deep. It worsens with movement of the joint and weight bearing, and it improves with rest. And it's maximal at extremes of joint motion. It's coming from inside the joint. It's coming from inside the house. And so some of these things are just giving you clues. Is the pain deep? It's from within side. Are the patients actually using those words? Intra-articular processes are usually associated with reductions in both active and passive range of motion, but peri-articular around the joint processes are associated with reduction in active range of motion only. When you're doing it, it doesn't hurt so much because the patient isn't actively engaging the structures that are causing the pain. It is all about location, location, location. The location of the joint pain can also provide a lot of diagnostic cues, as per our really helpful author and article here. The crystal-induced arthropathies typically affect the first metatarsophalangeal joint, so that big toe, and the knee. Septic arthritis also commonly involves the knee, though, or the hip. Rheumatoid arthritis typically smaller peripheral joints. But don't forget about referred pain, just because it's fun to know that joint pain can come from internal organs sometimes, just to keep you on your multi-articulated toes there. You have to do, just like every other day of being a PA, the bread and butter of what we do is a strong, strong history and physical. That is what marks you as a PA, that you're doing a strong one, and here's a really important time to do it. Be really careful with your ROS. Be really careful with your med list. Other things in there can tell you more about the diagnosis. For example, as per the article, sensation of giving way or locking a joint, in addition to joint pain and swelling, suggests ligament or cartilage disruption. Weakness in association with joint pain and swelling suggests neuromuscular causes. If weakness goes along with altered sensation, then we're talking nerve root or peripheral nerve. Fever can be an accompanying symptom for acute monoarthritis, but not really specific. But if there are constitutional symptoms like fever, weight loss, especially in combination with other symptoms like derm, ocular, vascular things, then that is more suggestive of a systemic rheumatic disease. Combinations can also suggest a reactive arthritis. Remember, can't see, can't pee, can't bend your knee. Arthritis, uveitis, diarrhea, conjunctivitis, that's looking like a reactive arthritis or a subtype of a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. Look for psoriatic nail changes or plaques. Maybe it's psoriatic arthritis. Look for ocular inflammation and back pain, and that could suggest ankylosing spondylitis. So the person is going to tell you a lot about what is causing their joint pain if you ask them the right questions, do the right physical exam. Really great table two of some drugs that cause musculoskeletal conditions that you don't want to miss, bisphosphonates, different cardiovascular meds, some really common meds on there. So definitely go to the article for those two really important tables. Your most important information is coming from the H&P. Labs and tests should really just give you more information when you aren't exactly sure. Synovial fluid is going to be huge. It's going to be key to know if this is a septic joint and to further evaluate monoarthropathies. In that synovial fluid, you're looking for color, WBC count, gram stain and culture, and a polarized light microscopy. Maybe you can't do that, but you want to know that whoever's looking at it is good at what they're doing. Normal synovial fluid should be clear. And a little reminder from the article that crystals being present doesn't mean it's not something else. You can have gout and also have a septic joint. So just because you saw crystals doesn't mean it's not something else. And if you're isolating infectious agents from the synovial fluid, it's most likely not gonococcal. It's hard to isolate infectious agents if it is gonococcal. You're going to think about blood uric acid. Doesn't have to be elevated if it's gout. CBC, metabolic panel, urine tests, they're not really needed unless you're thinking something systemic. If you think it's septic, definitely get blood cultures. If you think it's gonococcal, get a culture of the urethra, pharynx, rectum, cervix. You really only need rheumatoid lab tests if you're sure it's not some other acute process, inflammatory or non-inflammatory. Don't get an ANA if the patient has localized joint pain and no systemic symptoms. I think sometimes we just kind of want to throw the kitchen sink at these things. You might need imaging, x-ray, if conservative treatment isn't working. And the author points out, get some bilateral views, affected and unaffected. Except don't hang your hat on that. Most of the time, the x-ray doesn't make the diagnosis for you. If you need soft tissue in and around the joint, you need to visualize that. That's your CT, MRI, ultrasound. Again, just a reminder, you cannot miss septic arthritis, fracture, osteomyelitis, compartment syndrome, tumors, necrotizing fasciitis, or systemic vasculitides. They're worth saying twice. Treatment is totally going to depend on the diagnosis, and immediately refer appropriately if any of those above emergent things seem to be happening, and to rheumatology as necessary. But most monoarthropathies are going to get better with activity modification, with the right analgesia, and with local care. Really common thing presenting to everyone. Everyone's got joint pain. And it's not just, oh, let's just throw an NSAID at it. And it's not just throw a whole rheumatoid panel at it. I thought it was a great review.
Yeah, it's so easy just to, you know, order a, you know, rheumatology panel in your EHR that has, you know, all of these, you know, anti-Joes and all of those other weird, you know, rheumatology things, because those are meant to sort of specific sniper approach to your your patient and not a screening, hey, let's just check all of these, because several of those can be positive in patients that don't have the particular condition that that autoantibody may be positive for. So, you know, not all lupus patients have a positive ANA. So
exactly. Yeah, the sensitivity and specificity varies. You've got to know that about each test. And you have to think, how rare is this? So then what's the positive and negative predictive value too? I think we forget about those things sometimes when it's so easy to just click an order.
Yep. No, but a really good, really good breakdown of that.
Thanks. Yeah. Arthur did a great job.
So the next one we're going to jump into is specialty certification and clinical flexibility. And this was written by an army of authors from AAPA and Task Force, looking at the sort of history and the policy of special certifications and clinical flexibility of PAs. So some of the data that they talked about in the article was that 49% of PAs between 1969 and 2016 changed their specialties at least once in their career. So almost half of PAs, since we've been a profession, have changed their specialties at least once. 24% switch to another specialty class, and I'm assuming that means went to something that was just completely different than what they were in. Maybe they were in orthopedics and then they went to dermatology. And then 11% practiced in at least three specialties in their career. So there is a high degree of variability, and again, that's one of the strong points of the PA profession, is that we can go from specialty to specialty because we're generalist trained. We're trained to handle about anything that's come through the door. And that's one of the reasons why, since 2002, the AAPA has actually opposed specialty certification in some of their policies that they have made. So the AAPA Task Force on Flexibility and Specialty Certification, which is a lot of these task members, showed that in 1974, 68% of PAs were in primary care, but in 2016, 73% of PAs were in specialty practice, so almost completely opposite. There's a wide variability in data collection from the task force regarding the need for specialty certification, the ability to practice, the requirements for hiring, but there was a general consensus opposition if the Certificate of Added Qualifications, or the CAQ, were used as either criterion for licensure, criterion for credentialing, or criteria for entry into specialty practice or reimbursement. So there's a lot of people on different sides of the fence, depending on who you talk with. But as a general consensus, they opposed the CAQs being used for this. So the discussion of the article, and there's a lot more data in that, and I would highly recommend you go check out the article in JAPA to read this, because there's some very interesting commentary from all of these different organizations, but I'm just going to kind of wrap up with the discussion part. So the potential advantages of having specialty certifications is that it does provide some external validation of PA's expertise. So if you're a PA who's practiced in emergency medicine for 15 years, it would be nice for you to have a distinction for your level of expertise that isn't as easily known to a layperson or to somebody who's just coming in looking at your CV. So it does help provide some of that. It also helps with advancement through your specific organization. So if you're a member of the, say, SEMPA, which is the Society for Emergency Medicine PAs, or through specialty organizations that have CAQs, it can help you sort of move through the ranks of your service, or if you want to move into board of directors and those kind of things within those organizations. Now, the concerns are it may limit entry level into specialty practice, because if everybody starts requiring that you need to have a CAQ in psychiatry to come practice in the psychiatry office, well, how are you supposed to get that CAQ and get that experience if the only way to get experience is to get experience? So by requiring it, you may actually limit potential PAs from getting into your specialty, because they're requiring a certification that is contingent on them having experience in that particular specialty. It may also limit mobility among the specialties, because if everybody requires it, then you can't bounce, you know, from one to another. If you decide that, you know what, I need a change of scenery, I need to change what I'm doing, but the only way for me to do this is to go back and get this extra level of certification, and I've got to do that by doing X. So there's definitely some concerns with that. Now, they did highlight some areas where it could be appropriate to have a CAQ or a specialty certification, and that would be to show clear improvement in patient outcomes. If there was data out there that showed that PAs with specialty certification actually improve patient outcomes, then at that point, then 100%, I think a lot of people would be on board in supporting PAs getting these specialty certifications. But right now, there's really not a lot of data out there to support that. It's also helpful for advancement within your health system. Sometimes you need to have a specialty certification to move your way up the ranks within your organization, maybe not your subspecialty organization, but your health system organization, and that will then help you show your level of expertise. When is it inappropriate? Again, they highlighted the fact that they really oppose these specialty certifications being used for requirement for entry level specialty practice, requirement for credentialing, or requirement for reimbursement. There's no data out there to suggest that specialty certifications improves any of that. Now, one of the potential alternatives that this task force did recommend, which I actually really kind of liked, was this electronic clinical portfolio. And it was a way for you or practicing PAs to be able to document your entrustable professional activities or your EPAs and have it be externally reviewed. So you'd be able to have a living, breathing CV where you can update all of these EPAs that you're doing within your clinical practice that is then easy for somebody to then review externally to say, yes, this person has done all of these. They are an expert in their field. They don't have to go and do a whole nother level of certification. They have their documentation for this to begin with. And I thought that that was a great idea. It might be in its infancy stages of thinking about, but I certainly would be interested to see how that progresses in the future. So it's a fairly heavy article, but if you're interested in this, I highly recommend you go check it out, because there is some really good data in there. And certainly if you're thinking about getting a specialty certification, it's worth the read to educate yourself on it.
That was a good summary. I think that the pros are obvious, and especially when you said if we could have data to say, like, look, this makes a difference in patient care, that would be great. My opinion is I'm worried that will other professions see this as kind of like the board certification or a residency kind of in, if we're not exactly sure if we need it or not, will it become something that other professions or our physician colleagues think does have more data behind it? You know, that it's just the kind of next level when maybe we don't know that yet. I'd kind of want to see what the interprofessional opinion on them is too a little bit.
I agree. I 100% agree.
Okay. Our last article that we're going to wrap up with are cannabinoids, or cannabinoids, you can say what you like, in the use of refractory seizures. What is the role of cannabinol in refractory epilepsy? So this article is by Catherine M. LaFleur and Eric C. Nemec. And Catherine LaFleur was a student in the PA program at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut at the time that this article was written. Eric C. Nemec II is the Director of Research and Assessment and a Clinical Associate Professor in the PA program at Sacred Heart University, and they have no conflicts of interest. So the FDA has approved an oral cannabidiol medication for refractory epilepsy in patients with Dravet or Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So not just any refractory epilepsy, but those two syndromes specifically. And a little background on both of those. They're both severe epileptic syndromes that start in childhood. Outside the article, background, Drevet, I looked this up. Thank you, Dynamed. No association with Dynamed. I have nothing to disclose. I just like that product. Is rare. It's about 1 to 2% of childhood epilepsy, and it is usually refractive to meds, but still meds are the first-line treatment for it anyway. It's just they don't do a great job. Lennox-Gastaut is also really rare. It's about 4% of childhood epilepsy, and it is characterized by a triad of multiple concurrent seizure types, cognitive dysfunction, and slow spike waves on EEG. So, all right, so from now on, we're going to say CBD. Cannabidiol is CBD, and you may have heard of that in the news or just out in life. It is the non-psychoactive form of cannabis. THC is the psychoactive or psychotropic chemical in cannabis. The concentrations in CBD can vary really widely depending on who's making it and who's selling it. The FDA approval helps regulate dosing and increases access for people who live in states without medical marijuana access. It's a Schedule 5 controlled substance, so it should be something that a PA doesn't face too many barriers subscribing. Insurance pricing and coverage is still unknown, though. We're not exactly sure how it works, but the authors explain that it might work by preventing hyperarousability of neurons, may also regulate GABA and glutamate release, but again, not exactly sure. So right now it's indicated for kids 2 and over. It comes in a 100 milligram per mil oral solution, and it's dosed at 2.5 mg per kg twice a day, which can be increased by 2.5 mg per kg twice a day until a max dose of 10 mg per kg. You want to titrate up more slowly if the child has other meds on board or has a hepatic impairment. You're going to want to get LFTs first and repeat them at 1, 3, and 6 months, and then as needed. The evidence demonstrates, according to the authors, modest seizure reduction that's defined as 50% or more reduction in seizures, but some have shown more than 50% reduction, and two studies mentioned that parts of their study population became seizure-free. Other positive outcomes from CBD were better sleep, improved behavior, improved appetite, and improved cognitive function in some of the kids. However, it's not all good news. Other studies showed no change in seizure frequency in about 11% of the populations and no change in frequency in about 23% of the population. So it's kind of mixed. In summary, it works pretty well for some, but not for everyone. Most of the studies were at a dose of 10 mg per kg. Some went higher, but then they had to come back down because of adverse effects. It can impede other drug metabolism because it goes through our favorite drug metabolism pathway, that cytochrome P450. Studies have shown increased liver levels, increased LFTs, and other drug levels, especially like valproate when you're taking them at the same time. Wasn't studied in people over 55, so we don't know about adults here. It's a really good review of the FDA approving CBD for refractory seizures, specifically in those two syndromes. And now, aside as my commentary as a reviewer, my only concern is that at the beginning, at the end of this article, they say the article is about CBD and refractory seizures. But to be clear, the FDA has only approved is for refractory seizures. The FDA has only approved this for refractory seizures in those two very specific syndromes and not all refractory seizures and not all seizure disorders and in not all amounts. So that's our summary on CBD oil.
Yeah, you know, it's I got a little bit of a bone to pick with CBD oil, and again, this is personal side commentary. One of my favorite things that I've heard on a podcast that I really like is that if something is ever marketed as a cure-all, it cures nothing, and I kind of feel like CBD is going down that road. There's so many places that you can get that are non-FDA approved sources of CBD oil, and they say, oh, you can use it for this and this and this and this and this and this. And, you know, like you said, it's been FDA approved for two specific refractory seizure conditions. Not all seizures need it. And even if you have a seizure disorder that is refractory to medicines, if it's not one of these two, it's not FDA approved.
Right.
So I'm worried that studies like this or studies that show benefit like this, that's going to take off like wildfire and we're going to see a whole bunch of unregulated CBD coming down the pipeline. And like you said, it may not be FDA regulated, but it still goes in your medication history when you're taking a good history. and it can affect your metabolism of other prescription drugs. So you got to be careful and really make sure that you're screening your patients, that they're not taking it for other conditions.
Right. We don't have a ton of magic things that this works for everything except like diet, exercise, sleep.
Right.
So it is kind of, I think, getting like anecdotal panacea. And I think it's important that, especially as healthcare providers, we communicate really clearly that this is approved very specifically for these two rare seizure disorders in kids. And then we need to know a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know a little bit more about you. We're curious about what your answers to the questions from the editor would be. What do you think is the hardest thing to teach? And what were you grateful for that someone taught you that you didn't think you were going to get? That'd be nice to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us. You can tweet at us. Chris, can you tell us where to tweet?
So I'm at PA_Made on Twitter. Adrian is at The Art of EBM, all one word. JAPA is at JAPACOM. Harrison Reed, our associate editor of JAPA, is at Harrison Reed PA. So sound and sound engineering is done by myself. And again, if you haven't subscribed to our tune on iFeed, our tunes on iFeeds, our feed
it's
on
new.
iTunes or Stitcher, then please go and find us and give us a rating. Help us climb the ranks in the PA podcasting circles.
Yeah, please do. And we hope to see you back here next month.
Bye.
Bye.